Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. I am, as always, Reggie Darden, and I have another wonderful guest with me today. I got Mr. Evan Wiley, and we're going to just get into his journey and whatever other items that we decide to talk about. We'll get to that as well. But I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you. Where did the martial arts find you? Where did Kenpo find you? And kind of where did all that martial arts journey start for you?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on, Reggie. I think this is such a cool project that you've undertaken, and I'm really happy to share with you today and talk some martial arts. I started Kenpo in 1997, and I grew up in a fairly small town, maybe 2,000 people or so. And around that time, like so many other kids who were, 7 or 8 years old, I was really influenced by the action movies and the martial arts and movies at that time. I think that was the year of like Rush Hour with Jackie Chan, Twin Dragons, a bunch of the Seagal stuff. And I was really, really interested, especially in fighting. I thought sparring was the coolest thing, boxing, and really wanted to get involved in some sort of martial art. In Mount Bridges, the small town where I grew up, there was luckily enough, a Kenpo program that was running out of the elementary school on Friday nights for a couple hours. So that's where it all got started. And it was at that time, Jamie Seabrook was the teacher along with one of his black belt students. So I started in 97, and I'm still with Mr. Seabrook to this day, which is, I think this is my 28th year with him right now, which is super hard to believe. But it's really cool to be with the same person that entire time. And especially now things have kind of come full circle. I also opened up a karate school back in Mount Bridges. I live in London now, which is about half an hour away. But now we again have Kenpo back in Mount Bridges evenings when I go out there to run the school.
You're very nice, very nice. Now, is Kenpo the only style that I've been involved in, or?
No, I've been lucky enough as well. The entire time with Mr. Seabrook, we've been exposed to a lot of martial arts. Of course, he's got a background in Kung Fu and modern Arnis and Jiu-Jitsu. So I've really taken a shine to Filipino martial arts. So I also teach modern Arnis out there. And I started sort of more officially training in modern Arnis last year under Datu Tim Hartman. So those are kind of Arnis and Kenpo are really our focus. I'd say 90% Kenpo, maybe 10-ish% Arnis. And then a few times a year, I try to bring in other instructors from different disciplines as well to just expose everyone to, everything that's out there. We were super fortunate going through the system with Jamie because we got exposed to so many people. I mean, he would always be taking us places within Canada, even abroad, to learn with so many other really, really great martial artists. I remember, one of those sort of like aha moments in, I think it was 2005. Jamie had put together a demo team that was going to perform at the 2005 LTKKA camp in Las Vegas during the dinner ceremony. So we got to go out there and do that. And more importantly, we got to train with, some of the absolute greats. I think that was the first time, could be wrong, it might have been the year before, but I think that was the first time that I had seen in person Larry Tatum and was able to attend one of his seminars. And if you've ever done that, it's just the very first time you see him move and you see Kenpo like that, I was just mind blown at what was possible. And I was only, I was 15 then, so it left a huge, huge impact on the rest of my Kenpo journey.
Very nice. Yeah, my instructor, he got his third and fourth degrees from Larry Tatum. And I have yet to actually meet Mr. Tatum in person. Just yet, but I'm feverishly working on getting him on the show, getting to talk to him. So looks pretty exciting. So so going back to the kind of the early parts of when you started, were you kind of able to pick things up pretty well, or
kind of it's a great
question with that?
Yeah, I mean, so I remember being, you know, 7-8 years old, and since sparring was really like that, that was the driving force for me. That at that time for sure was my favorite thing. I still remember getting my first set of Century Turtle sparring gear, and just cherishing it. I really enjoyed kata and forms. And I remember I worked super, super hard at that as a kid. And we had lots of tournaments that we were lucky to have, you know, a few local circuits around. So forms and sparring at that age definitely felt the best. I remember techniques always initially being like, oh my goodness, there's just so much here. So I would say from, you know, 7 until I got my junior black belt in 2004. And up until junior black, I remember just being like, oh my goodness, these techniques are tough. Keeping everything straight and really trying to not only have the moves memorized, but have them work for you was just such a tough piece of the system. But it takes time. I mean, with, you know, 157 base moves, 96 extensions, I mean, even right now, it's something that I'm just constantly working at. But now, of course, you know, the techniques feel good. I absolutely love and appreciate the body time to really, really work the kinks out.
Yeah, I think it's crucial to be able to kind of work the techniques, work the basics, work all the different material on people, and instead of just kind of doing the quote unquote air karate.
Right.
You really have to, you know, feel, you know, you have to really feel it and be able to get those, you know, get your hands and feet on people to really kind of understand how the mechanics of everything works. So.
Oh yeah. Trial by fire.
Exactly.
What about you, Reggie? When did you get started in Kenpo?
So I started in the, I guess, early to mid 90s, after seeing, The Perfect Weapon. I, found a school and, got hooked up. Actually, my best friend and I, my best friend actually started before me. But I would be at the school every day from when they opened till when they closed. And I watched every class and I was just trying to kind of soak up what I could. And then, my friend would kind of sneak off and give me things, here and there. So, when I finally got to start myself, I was probably pretty ahead of the game. I just would be at class, as much as I possibly could, and which was pretty much every day. And,
nice.
Yeah, we would just train and just work, techniques and stuff on each other. The school that I started at was basically kind of followed the Tracy's curriculum.
Okay.
Although I wouldn't say we were actually a Tracy's school, but that kind of curriculum was what we did. So we had 40 techniques per belt, which is
easy, right?
Is a lot to pick up on. Although it, in contrast to my training now, even though we had more technique, so I'm on my current training, I'm doing the 16 technique curriculum, And
very nice.
At my original school, we didn't have the terminology. We didn't have most of the sets. So we had more techniques, but less of kind of the other things. So with my training now, it's like, oh, well, I feel like there's, even though there's less techniques, I feel like there's more that I have to learn now. So it's been a little tricky. I'm very used to being able to just, you know, do the movements and do the techniques, but having to remember all the sayings and the pledges and things like that are a little bit trickier for me. So, which I don't have the best study habits, but yeah, that's
fair. There's just so much there.
Yeah. It's a big journey. So,
Oh, good for you.
I wanted to, so since you were training at a young age, and the thing, something that's kind of come up in just kind of recent times, or looking at the current kind of generation. So yesterday on my Facebook, I came across a little meme or a little picture or whatnot of some parents, and they were bringing in their little kid, and it was like, oh, well, like, we want Johnny to learn some discipline, and the instructor's getting them signed up. And in the next panel of this image, it has 6 months later, and it has the parents sitting with the little Johnny. This time Johnny has so in the first picture, the little Johnny has his gi on, and he's ready to go. And in the second picture, he's got his headphones on, and he's looking at his iPad, and the parents are like, oh, well, we're stopping classes because, you know, Johnny's not interested anymore. So for me, I am very much not into letting your children quit the martial arts, or
right,
kind of really quit anything at such kind of a young age, and before they've really got a chance to really let the process kind of work for you. So I'm kind of curious, in your training as a young person, you know, kind of, did you have those moments of, oh, well, you know, this is hard, so I don't want to do this anymore, and kind of how that aspect of it, or how your training maybe kind of compares to kind of the today's mindset of a lot of the young people? They get into something, and then the second it gets a little bit too tough, they're ready to quit. And just kind of what are your kind of thoughts on that?
Oh, it's a great question. I absolutely love that. I was really fortunate, actually. Since martial arts was my own decision, it had nothing to do with my parents. I wasn't pushed into it. At no time was there any pressure for me to keep going or increase the intensity. Now, that being said, as a result of both that and, you know, the other big component is the school you're at and the teacher that you're with, that can play such a tremendous role in the longevity of the students. So I never faltered in those 28 years. There was never a time where, you know, I wanted to quit or I was getting bored. Truthfully, though, I chalk most of that up. I mean, you probably know this from other areas as well. Good teachers are hard to find. Good teachers are really hard to find. Great teachers are one in a million. And luckily enough for me, Jamie was one of those one in a million. And I think he also found a way to always keep things fresh, even as kids. So, you know, we used to have one class a month that was always a super special topic. And I remember for the kids, I mean, it's something even I do now at my school, that was something tremendous to look forward to. You know, no matter how hard your forms were or wherever you were in the curriculum, once a month, we're going to have this super special topic. You know, sometimes with Jamie, it would be like for a whole year, Thursday nights, we're going to do, you know, we're going to do jiu-jitsu. Or Thursday nights, we're going to learn like a super high up Kenpo form or one of the set twos. We did a year of nothing but FMA on Thursdays. And I feel like that was such a smart idea because it really, it gave you something to look forward to, even when you were definitely down and in the trenches with the material that you were at. So I recognize I'm super fortunate in that regard to have been with like a teacher like that. But I think that made a huge difference. It always kept things fresh and stuff never got stale. Had we not had that, I mean, I really don't know. I can see, especially as, you know, a teenager, young adult trying to get through this really tough curriculum being like, okay, I mean, where is the end and how do I keep myself motivated? So I think that made a huge, huge impact.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about Mr. Seabrook is that he is all about keeping things fresh, going at things at different angles and kind of really making the training worthwhile and not stale and. You know, because Kenpo is always evolving, and the fact that he's doing things with, you know, adding in the FMA, adding in the jiu-jitsu, and just keeping it moving, I think is something that makes it much easier to keep things fresh, keep things moving, keep the students engaged in the training. So
same with, I mean, I'll say when, you know, and developmentally it just worked out well for where I was at that particular age. But I remember, you know, when I was a teen, like, you know, 17, 18, like around that time, we also did a lot of traveling. And that always gave me something to look forward to as well. Like some of my best memories of Kenpo around that time, we used to, there'd be, you know, I think four or five of us would jump in Jamie's car and we would drive to a school, Michael Miller's Kenpo in Bradford, Pennsylvania. And we did that like, I think a couple times a year anyways, for a pretty decent stretch of time. And it was a blast because we would go out there, we would do fantastic training. I mean, Mr. Miller is one of the most humble people. Like they welcomed us in with open arms. And we had some pretty big people come out there as well. I mean, another one, you know, I've talked about that first aha moment with Mr. Tatum. Another one was out there in Bradford, Pennsylvania. And it was 2013 with Grandmaster Pick. And I remember that the topic of the seminar that day was knife to the kill. And I just, it just blew my mind watching what he did. I remember, I think the first technique we worked on was deflecting hammer, but we have a knife, and sort of his application and adaptation and just being like, this is insane. Like, this is such cool stuff. So always having those things to look forward to as well, it was fuel for the fire. There was always something coming up or someone new that we were going to be training with, and it was exciting.
Yeah, no, Mr. Pick is the go-to person when it comes to knife work, and I'm a bit jealous. I have not had a chance to meet him or train with him yet, but he's definitely one of those people that his name comes up and everyone right away is, that's the man to learn from. So and just very kind of legendary status on his accomplishments and teaching.
Oh, and super nice. Like I remember when we got to Mr. Miller's, he was just sitting outside on a chair and, you know, just seems like not a care in the world. Super, super chill. And I remember being like, okay, well, this is interesting. This isn't exactly what I would have expected. 10 minutes later, when he walks in that back door in his gi, and it, like, the intensity, everything had just changed. And I remember being like, oh, wow, okay. And then after we had got, you know, moving for 5 or 10 minutes and being like, oh my goodness, it was just the emotion that he evoked out of everybody was unbelievable. Yeah, it was something special.
Very nice. So what are maybe some of the other teachers that you've got to work with that kind of stand out to you? Any kind of?
Yeah. Oh my, there's so many. We feed so lucky. Another one I'll say though, and it definitely falls in that aha category, was probably 2 years ago, the first time I got to work with Mr. Durgan. And again, seeing him move and the adaptation and application of moves, it was one of those jaw-dropping moments, being like, this is so refreshing and cool to see a completely different spin on a lot of moves. I mean, he still does like so much of the Kenpo that, you know, you and I may do, but he has a lot of differences in terms of extensions and the contact manipulations off of the base moves. And I hadn't seen a lot of that piece of the arc per se. And that really stuck with me. I mean, it was like, wow, we can really go in a lot of different directions from here based on those manipulations. So yeah, Mr. Durgan has been a big influence on where I see my Kenpo going as well.
Very nice. Okay, so can you talk a little bit about the transition from going from the kind of the junior side of it, the junior black belt, and into the adult curriculum, and kind of what were your experience with that, and how did that transition go for you?
Sure. Yeah. So with us, with Mr. Seabrook, going through to junior black belt, we were tested on all of the forms. And we had techniques as well, but we weren't held to having every single technique for the belt. That was the kid system. It was really based on the forms, sparring. We still had to do techniques, but it wasn't everything. So the transition from junior black to black belt was a big one. And I remember we would go through right at the beginning again. So starting at yellow belt, we would do those techniques. We would work them. And once he was satisfied, we would get a stripe on our junior black belt saying that, okay, we've now crossed off those yellows. Then we went to orange, and we were doing the 24 system, I should say. So now here we are, 24 techniques to knock off before we get that next stripe. So the grind from junior black to first degree black, it was real. I mean, that was, I don't remember exactly how long that took, how many years, whether it was two or around there, but it was a lot of material to cover. But I did appreciate, at least we still had this feedback and acknowledgement by getting those stripes on the belt for each color level of techniques that we knocked off. Like, you could start to feel that you were getting close, and that made a big difference, because, you know, starting out being like, oh my gosh, 157. And when it comes time to, you know, first degree black, like, we got to have those. Like, who knows what's going to be called out at the test? We need to have those cold. So it was a really tough for me, especially the names. I remember getting the moves. You know, I was at around that time, I would have been 14, 15. So I was picking up the moves reasonably well. I couldn't keep the names straight for the life of me. I remember just sitting there with, you know, I had a printed out sheet of the curriculum, and just like going through it, just reading it out to try to get the names to stick. And it was such a struggle, Reggie. It was such a struggle.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to that. It's been a little minute since I've tested. I'm actually working on testing for my stripe here, and probably be going up for my third brown probably by the summer as we're recording here. But
oh wow,
we'll see how see how we go with that. But yeah, keeping kind of everything straight in my mind, you know, like we mentioned with the terminology and the sayings and things like that, it's I can get the kind of the gist of it, but the exact wording just kind of always escapes me. And
yes, and especially I'll say, you know, in the heat of the moment, like I remember it was probably my first degree test in 2006, when you're standing up there and you know, you're nervous, something is called out, you think you've heard one thing, but it's actually something different, you know, like, oh, you know, I like to see entwined maces, and, you know, in my mind, I'm like, oh, entwined lens. Okay, I got this. And, you know, rip through the technique and be like, okay. And Mr. Seabrook would be, you know, would say, that was a really good entwined lens, but that's not what I, you know, I want to see entwined maces. Being like, ah, right. You know what I mean? Like, they're just, some of these names get so close. It's really easy to mix them up.
Yeah. No, I've told this story on previous episodes, but during one of my tests, I started going through coordination set. Let's see, which one was it? I think it was coordination set 2. And I get about halfway through it, and then I stop, and I go, "Oh, I was asked to do blocking set 2," and my instructor was like, "Yeah, we were wondering when you were going to catch on to that." And
that's awesome.
Tests. I get pretty nervous with testing, even though I most of the time know my stuff pretty well. It was just my mind just kind of well, usually if I notice that I made a mistake, then I kind of start getting in my head a little bit too much and kind of start spiraling, and then things kind of go from there. But
yeah, that's just it. And I mean, you know, especially with forms and during a test, it's like it's your one shot, right? I mean, your instructor knows you know this. You know it. But when it comes to, you know, and especially if you've got like the panel at the front, you've got a room full of spectators, and it's like, I've got one chance to put my best foot forward on this particular form. I do not want to make a mistake. It's a lot of pressure. It is really, really difficult.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. So let's move over to the teaching side of it. Well, when did you get involved in the teaching part? And was that something that always had interested you, or did you kind of warm up to it? Were you thrown into it, as some of my previous guests have had? How did the teaching part start for you?
Sure. With my own school, I opened the doors in 2019. So that's 519 Combatives. We opened in January of that year. So that's when sort of me on my own with my own school started. But really the seeds were sown well before that. I didn't necessarily as a kid ever expect to become an instructor or to teach. I remember probably around 2007, 2008, when I was 17, 18. Mr. Seabrook was away at a conference or something had come up, and he needed someone to run classes. And every now and then when he'd be away, he'd ask, you know, one of his black belts, get them the opportunity to teach all of the classes for that week. So I remember that was my first time sort of at the helm. No one else is in the room. You know, there'd be times before that where we would help out with a class, and we break out into groups, and, you know, sort of that was the earliest levels of teaching, but still very much under the supervision of Mr. Seabrook. But that first time that I ran classes for him, I remember I honestly probably didn't sleep for like 3-4 days before the classes. And I was just so nervous. I knew exactly what I wanted to teach. There was a beginner class, an intermediate, and there was an advanced class. And I knew everyone at the school very well. So there was, you know, there wasn't like it was strangers. But oh boy, was I nervous. And I remember after teaching that Thursday night, coming home and being like, oh my gosh, that went so much better than I expected. And that was so fun. Like, you know, even though I had all of these ideas and plans for what I wanted to go through, I mean, we did some of it, but then it was just this, you know, give and take of someone would ask a question, we would adapt, and it just ended up being this really great experience. And I thought, okay, this is something I could totally see myself doing at some point in time. So then in 2019, actually, I guess a little bit before that, probably 2018, 2017, I remember looking for a place to run classes out of. And it was so hard to find a location. And I knew, you know, if there was nothing in Mount Bridges where I had grown up, it'd be so great to bring Kenpo back to that community. And I remember checking, you know, the community centers. We had some legions. I couldn't find anything. And then 2019, there was a small boutique gym that had opened up. I mean, it was small. It was open floor space, like kind of equipment on the outside. But like, I don't know, maybe like 500 square feet of space, maybe. Super, super small. But it was open mats, open floors. So I thought I'll talk to the owner. So I did that, and they were super open to it. At that time, I started on Saturday mornings, just running a single class out of there. And it was a total throwback to, you know, 2007, 2008, the nerves, just being like, oh my gosh, everything has to be perfect. I'm so nervous. But it went well. Again, it went really, really well. After about a year, it started to build up, especially I started with adults. And then I started getting inquiries for a lot of kids. So yeah, we currently have, I guess, about five classes, five different groups, primarily kids. Difficult thing was starting in 2019, of course, things got turned upside down pretty quickly after opening the doors in 2020. But, you know, I mean, we adapted. We had to physically lock down for whatever that was, a year or so. But we kept it alive on Zoom for a lot of people, which made a big difference. And then when I could start being outside and teaching outside, miraculously all the students stuck around. And yeah, now we're just sort of going full swing out there a few nights a week.
Very nice. With the shutdowns, I mean, were you concerned about potentially having to kind of shut down? Were you able to embrace the remote learning? Or so kind of when I was first coming up, and maybe even now still, I kind of see that, but there was a lot of resistance to remote learning, and which, you know, there wasn't, of course, as much as there is now, but
right.
And just kind of what was the initial feelings and thoughts about, you know, how are we going to proceed with the training with, you know, things getting locked down?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I was definitely nervous. I thought for sure. I thought no one's going to stick around. Even if people decide to take a break, I thought this is going to be tough to get them back in who knows how long. I mean, it was that really big unknown. I did know, though, you know, even if I had one or two people stick, so long as I could cover the rent, I was going to be back there. As long as, you know, as long as we could do that, it didn't matter whether I had two students or whether I had 40, it was going to be a go. But the Zoom was a big question mark too. I mean, I didn't have a lot of space at that time to be doing Kenpo at home. I remember I had this, was like basically a tablet for a computer, and thought, okay, how is this going to work? Like, how am I going to keep people engaged when I'm not even in the room? You know, like they're in their own homes, in their bedrooms or wherever, like the distractions are going to be immense. But it's funny. So we did that, and it actually worked out quite well. Of course, it was all primarily, you know, like a lot of forms work that we did. Some techniques, but techniques were difficult to, I mean, especially for like the 8 to 10 year olds to explain and the angles on camera. But the forms we really kept going strong. And it was funny, I had a few parents reach out to me at various points after we had started this about how big of a difference it made in their kids' lives. That, you know, everything had been taken away from them. I mean, they couldn't even see their own friends effectively, but they were so excited on, you know, Thursday nights to log on and know that they were going to be doing Kenpo and they were going to still be learning their material. And I just thought that was the coolest thing, because it didn't strike me that way. You know, I thought, okay, everyone's just dealing. I didn't realize that for so many, this was still very much a highlight of their lives during a time when everything else had sort of been taken away.
Nice. Now, do you still have a kind of remote online component to the teaching, or now that kind of everything is kind of quote back to normal, is just strictly in person?
That's a great
now,
question. Or? Yeah, it basically is. The only difference is I have a couple of students who moved away, and they have, you know, they have no Kenpo where they are. I mean, some of them are in pretty rural areas and there's just nothing. So I've agreed to, you know, to continue working with them over Zoom. It's only a couple of students, but otherwise, since we're local, everything is back in person.
Nice.
But there's a place for it, right? I mean, I feel like a lot of people were really harsh on the learning online, learning via. And I totally get it. But at the end of the day, if it's a matter of training or not training, it's a hard argument to justify. You know, like, come on, we've got people who are still sticking with it. Is it ideal? No, but it's something. And I think that's the key. And I'm still a little surprised so many people have been as averse to it as they have been or are.
Exactly.
Did you do anything, any online learning during that time, Richard?
No, I actually wasn't really training. I wasn't really training actively when COVID kind of reared itself around. I stopped training kind of formally, Kenpo when I left for the military in 96. While I was in the Army, I did some Hapkido and some Taekwondo and some boxing and stuff, and just kind of trained on my own. And then I got involved in capoeira and was kind of really focused in on that. But the kind of a few months before, well, maybe, I don't know, I guess maybe a year or so before COVID and everything, I wasn't training as much. And then I met my now wife, and so doing the whole dating thing, I wasn't really training it as much as I used to.
Sure.
And I was getting ready to make my triumphant return to training after I got married, but I got married right before things got shut down, so that just kind of put a halt to everything, and didn't know kind of where things were going. And I was about to get back into it, and then kind of the new variant or whatever, that kind of first evolution of the whole situation kept me from training again. So yeah, I would have, had I really kind of thought about maybe trying to do the remote thing, and I probably would have been all into that, but
sure. Sure.
Uh, uh, And then also I hadn't really gotten back into Kenpo at that point. So I didn't really do much in the training during the whole kind of shutdown and everything, but kind of once we got past that, then I was all in, and now I'm training five arts currently. So
love it.
It's important to have a very supportive spouse to
That's right.
When you say, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna sign up for this class now," and so there's not enough hours in the day for everything, but trying.
That's funny. I like the supportive spouse piece. You know, against all better logic, when I was getting ready for my sixth degree test over the last year, and I'm lucky enough, you know, Matt Trejo's not far away, so you know we get together all the time. But I was really wanting to get reps in. So my wife, she actually has a black belt from way back. She doesn't really train it anymore in a traditional style. But I was like, I really need an uki. So we would she would be downstairs with me, and she would be my uki for, you know, some of these nasty Kenpo techniques. I remember everyone being like, do not ask your partners, your wives to stand in and be your uki. But you know what? She did it, and she hasn't kicked me out. So it worked this time anyways, Reggie. It worked this time.
Well, you know, family that trains together stays together. So
it can
definitely work. Definitely works.
Yes. I'll also say, you know what, about the whole Zoom thing and being online, from a teaching standpoint, I also feel like I gained a ton. I mean, when you're trying to, you have to explain things in a completely different way when it's on screen than you do in person. I mean, you don't have the luxury of being able to go over and physically manipulate an arm or leg into the position that it needs to be. So I feel like it really helped me not only see things different, but also be able to explain it in ways that have to be really, really, really simple or simplified, so that people can, you know, actually understand what you mean and what you're doing. So, you know, from the teaching standpoint, I felt like, okay, that actually really, really helped me.
Very nice. Very nice. So to kind of jump back or kind of touch on what we were kind of talking about earlier with the whole kind of motivating the kids and kind of keeping them from quitting, and then just as your experience as an instructor, what kind of maybe tips or ideas that you have in regards to dealing with both the students that want to quit just because they're kind of reaching the difficulty, and maybe in kind of, in my opinion, more importantly, dealing with the parents of these kids that are willing to just kind of let their kids stop these things. How do you address those things, or what kind of tips would you want to maybe put out there for that sort of thing?
Sure. And it's tough. It really is a tough one. One of the things that I currently do, and we talked about this before, that Jamie did with us all the time, was I have those special classes. So in all of my classes, regardless of the ages, they know once a month we're going to have this dedicated class. Usually for us, it's FMA. So it's working either forms, it's working Sinawalis, whatever it is. There's that piece that is different from their Kenpo training that they're going to get to see once a month, no matter what. And that really definitely seems to help keep people interested, especially for those who are at those difficult, pivotal times where they're grinding through their forms and they just don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. They know they've got that there. I also try to have somewhat of a structured program, not only in terms of, you know, that dedicated class, but them also knowing that, you know, we're a really heavy sparring school. So they know that no matter, we're going to have some classes that are basically all forms. We almost fight every night, but sometimes it's going to have to be all forms or all techniques. But they know that there's going to be also almost once a month a dedicated full class of hitting the pads and just putting on the gear and sparring. And again, it keeps it fresh, and it also gives them something to look forward to. Now, the piece about when they're struggling, it's tough. I mean, I try to be as honest with them as I can. And usually, you know, at the end of classes, not every class, but often, I'll sit them down and you know, we'll talk about difficult things. And one of those is, and I always articulate that, you know, Kenpo, and as we go higher and higher in the ranks, it just demands so much more. And like things that demand so much more, those are usually the things worth fighting for. So I always mention that, you know, it's so few people get to that level. So few people get to black belt. But if you can stay committed, and if you recognize that it's going to be a struggle, that's the first part. If you expect that this is going to be a easy journey, you've got something else coming, right? So I think the expectation that, okay, there's going to be ebbs and flows. And certainly as we get to certain points, it's hard. And it's not just hard for you. It was hard for me. It's been hard for everyone. But we've got to find a way to push ourselves through it. So I don't know how effective that is, but I feel like it at least is transparent about what the path looks like. And then the parents. I mean, I do try to articulate with the parents as much as possible that the skills and what they gain from sticking it out, especially around, you know, I would say like the 12 to 15 year old, like there tends to be a lot of drop off around that age, transition to high school, sports, everything else. They gain so much more by sticking it out, right? And it's not just the skills of hand-to-hand combat or martial arts. It's that perseverance. It's that discipline. It's all of these things that are going to translate well beyond their karate futures. So I try to let them know that it really is important that they are not pushing their kids, but they are firm in sticking this through. And also that, you know, like, this is not something you come to when you feel like it. And you'll always get some of those. And that's tricky, where, you know, you see someone twice a month. But that doesn't do anybody any favors. And a lot of that is on the parent's side. There has to be this acknowledgement from them that they are also a key piece of this journey. And, you know, you need the structure and you need to keep them there as best you can. Now, I get at some points, someone might say, this isn't for me. And it's tough to motivate and keep someone in who feels like there's nothing for them or they've lost all interest. But I think the parents can also do a lot more in those cases to just try and, you know, rekindle that motivation.
I like it. I like it. Yeah. Yeah. It's a struggle, but it's a worthwhile struggle. And there's so many skills that you get from the martial arts that it's a shame that there's so many, you know, parents and young people that don't grasp that and kind of let that fall by the wayside. And I think
that's it.
Be a lot better off having more people you know, stick with it and train and get those skills, life building skills.
Right. The tough things, that's what I keep saying, the tough things are worth fighting for. And they're going to experience it in school. They're going to experience it in team sport. They're going to experience it in post-secondary. I mean, you can't just throw in the towel and expect to be bailed out in all of these situations. The tough things are worth fighting for.
All right. So we're going to move on to our lightning round here. Got a few little questions to throw at you as we head towards wrapping up. So the first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Oh, the favorite technique. You know what? I really don't have a favorite technique. I'll say lately what I really love sort of as a class or a kind of category of techniques, I really appreciate the combination techniques. So if we think like, you know, I mean, you're working at some of the Brown stuff, like the double punches, the jab cross techniques, the, you know, circling fans, protecting fans, entwined maces, unfurling crane. I like the intensity that comes with those. You know, arguably the early techniques, yellow, orange, those are the most practical. That's what a lot of people are going to deal with. You know, these dead attacks, grabs, pushes, and we can add intensity to them. But I love that for the combination techniques, I mean, that intensity is built in. So yeah, I'd say it's probably, I couldn't pick one, but it would be sort of that category of things.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a nice one. I like that. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Yes. I mean, that one I definitely do. On the form side, it's tough. I'm a huge short form three fan. I used to, especially in tournaments, that used to always be my competition form. But I will say long form seven would be my favorite form. And I know that form gets a lot of flack from a lot of people, but it's a beautiful form. And the application of the Kenpo techniques with two sticks, and even how we're picking up the checks and like the way we're manipulating our opponent, long seven is special. On the set side, that's an easy one for me. That's stance set two. Stance set two, I think, is just phenomenal. I mean, especially at getting everybody to sort of realign their upper and lower halves. Like everything is working in unison. And I remember actually the very first time I learned stance set two, it was from Jill Tatum. She was doing a seminar, and that was even the first time I had seen the set. I remember being like, this is different. Like, this is totally, totally different. And I love that one. It's like a warm up set all the time for me right now.
Yeah,
do you have a favorite, Reggie?
Two things. One, I believe, when I started doing this show and I started asking that question, I was kind of surprised how much love the stance sets were getting. And if I remember correctly, the artist formerly known as Brittany Tatum, you know, she's now married, so. I believe she chose stance set two one of her favorites. I believe also Barbara White, I think, also picked that. There was a few people that had mentioned that, so I was kind of surprised by that.
Oh, interesting.
And then as for me, I have partial preference. To book set. And when I was speaking with Mr. Seabrook, I believe I told him that kind of one of the things that I was happy to notice when I discovered him is that I was looking for videos of people doing book set, and I think his was one of the first ones that I came across. And
That's awesome.
So yeah, I'm pretty partial to book set and Tiger and Crane, which, you know, the American Kenpo, some of the American Kenpo folks may be like, oh, well, those aren't Kenpo forms. It's like, I don't care. I learned them I learned book set in a Kenpo school, and
nice.
That's probably one of my go-tos, and until I can get someone to teach me Tiger and Crane and Short Four, which
nice.
we will not get into the debate about whether or not there really is a Short Form Four, but yeah.
What about Bridge? Do you do any? Because I know a lot of schools don't do this either. Have you done much of the freestyle?
We do the freestyle. Oh, cool. So yeah, at my original school, we did not do that, but
sure.
The school that I'm at now, we do freestyles.
Oh, very cool, very cool.
So, all right, very nice, very nice. All right, the next question: do you have a favorite weapon?
No, I wouldn't say I have a favorite weapon. I think because of how much FMA I've been doing lately, and sort of reigniting that passion and going down that path. I really do love I spend a lot of time with the double club. I mean, all of the Sinawalis that we do. I would probably say that. Now, of course, the Filipino martial arts, all of those translate to bladed weapons. You know, whether it's like the bolo, the barong, the short swords, any of those could sub in. But a big fan of the double club and the application that could be so many different things. That could be beer bottles. That could be a crowbar. That could be anything.
Very nice. I like it. Right. The next question, if there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
That's a great question. That's such a fun question. Are you a movie buff, Rich?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I would say on this one, do you remember Kill Bill?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Pai Mei. I would choose Pai Mei. I just think, there was something about the portrayal of, of course, he was this kung fu master. But the first time, I saw that movie, and when he bought Beatrix the 5-point palm exploding heart technique, I was like, okay, this guy's got some other stuff he's hiding. There's something else there that I would love to see. And I just loved the mentality as well. This like super old school, really, really strict, authoritarian, like they dramatized it way up. But I thought this is a cool fictional character. Pai Mei all the way.
I like it. Yeah, I grew up with the Black Belt Theater and the Kung Fu Theater, and saw all those old school movies, the Shaw Brother movies and whatnot. So seeing that in that movie was definitely a nice throwback to those films. So
right.
I like them. Right. Cool. And the next question is, what is something that is always a inspiration for you to train? So to kind of clarify this, I use the Rocky IV, the training montage of Rocky IV. Every time I see that movie, that scene, him running in the snow and chopping the wood and lifting boulders and all of those things, I'm ready to hit the mat and get the training. So, what is something like that for you? And it could be anything: movie, music, a person, a book, a video game, whatever it is that you just consume it and you're ready to get training. Now, what is that something for you?
Oh, super cool. No, I like that. I wouldn't say there's necessarily a movie or anything pop culture wise. Though I love, so many scenes in Rocky, you can't watch without being like, all right, let's get to it. I will say for me now, though, one of the, if not the biggest motivation is still every time that I teach. Every class, I leave being so much more excited after, like even some of the questions that, like a 7-year-old will ask me about a technique or watching a 6-year-old or a 9-year-old do one of these forms just really reinforces how important this is, not only passing on the art, but also, developing and enriching the lives of these students. And that just motivates me beyond belief. Watching my students move the way they do, ask the questions they do, it gets me excited.
Nice. I like it. All right. So we have now reached the point for shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything you'd like or anything else that you wanted to get out there for today. You have the floor. Feel free to put out anything you like, and we'll kind of go from there.
Sure. Well, thanks, Reggie. I've got nothing to promote, but I just have to say again, I mean, thanks a bunch. I love any opportunity to talk about anything Kenpo or martial arts related. And really, I think this is a fantastic project. I mean, how cool to sit down with so many people, I mean, effectively archive these conversations via what we're doing and really be able to spread what so many people are doing. So good on you. I think this is really, really cool.
Very nice. Yeah, no, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me your story and kind of get on some other items. We'll definitely have to do this again at another point and kind of drill down on some more specific points. But yeah, I just thank you so much for taking the time to be on, and I can't wait to get this shared out to my dozens of listeners, and we will definitely have to do this again.
Awesome. Thanks, Reggie.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.